89.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning. This is Peter Phillips from Project Censored on the Morning Mix Show. And joining me this morning is Dr. Cynthia McKinney from Sonoma State University. Cynthia Boaz. I knew I was going to do that. And also, her specialty is nonviolent social movements. And joining us also in studio today is Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs, and Jeff Meckler from talking about the peace march this weekend. And we'll have an update on Richard Kozner, the attorney who's on a hunger strike in Sonoma County on immigrant rights. So up next, the news with Rose Katachi.
I'm Rose Katachi with these news headlines. Rebel fighters in Libya say they've been hit again by NATO airstrikes in another apparent mistake. A doctor says at least two rebels were killed and more than a dozen were hurt near the front lines outside the eastern oil port of Brega. It would be the second accidental NATO strike against rebel forces in less than a week. Rebels say the attack forced them to retreat. Several militiamen fleeing back toward rebel-held Ajdabiya in eastern Libya say they saw several of their tanks destroyed by apparent NATO bombing runs. Rebel leaders had earlier complained that NATO airstrikes were carried out too slowly to help with their two-month-long cause. Meanwhile, a top U.S. general tells Congress that a stalemate appears to be emerging in Libya between rebels and forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi, who has appealed in a letter to U.S. President Barack Obama for a stop to airstrikes. His plea was bluntly dismissed yesterday by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Mr. Gaddafi knows what he must do. There needs to be a ceasefire. His forces need to withdraw from the cities that they have forcibly taken at great violence and human cost. There needs to be a decision made about his departure from power. And as the foreign minister said, his departure from Libya.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates is telling troops in Iraq that his visit this week will probably be his last as Pentagon chief. Gates gave a pep talk today to soldiers just outside Baghdad. Gates has said he intends to step down as defense secretary sometime this year, but he has not named a specific date. Still no deal on a budget to take the federal government through this fiscal year. President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden are set to meet with House Speaker John Boehner and Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid at the White House today for more negotiations. Republicans say they have prepared a temporary spending bill, while the president says temporary stopgap measures are not good for the economy. Obama is also warning against the damage a government shutdown would do. Hundreds of thousands of people will stop receiving paychecks after Friday if the two sides don't make a deal. Yesterday, Republican Congressman of Indiana Mike Pence spoke at a Tea Party rally telling Democrats to bring it on. Bring on a government shutdown.
The liberals in the Senate would rather play political games and force a government shutdown instead of accepting a modest down payment on fiscal discipline and reform. I say shut it down.
The government will lose authority to spend money as of Friday night at midnight. Senator Harry Reid says Democrats have met the Republicans halfway by agreeing to $33 billion in cuts. But House Speaker John Boehner, under pressure from some House Republicans, is demanding more. And beyond the numbers and ideological intransigence, some Republicans are saying they cannot agree to any budget that includes funding for Planned Parenthood or for the president's health care law. California Governor Jerry Brown has begun laying out the possible consequences of balancing California's remaining $15.4 billion budget deficit solely through spending cuts, including a doubling of University of California tuition, as Brown pushes for a compromise with Republicans on his proposal for a special election on taxes. As part of his latest attempt to win Republican support, Brown is calling on people to hug a Republican.
Hug a Republican. Make him feel good. Tell them it ain't that bad.
That's Brown speaking to the Police and Sheriff's Convention in Sacramento yesterday.
Two governors have led the way. Ronald Reagan, who was willing to raise the corporate tax, the income tax, and the sales tax, and Pete Wilson. Of course, I saw Pete once. I said, Pete, that was a pretty big tax increase. He didn't say anything. So he had the right to remain silent, but it's true. He had the same program, half taxes, half cuts.
In a separate address to the California Hospital Association, Brown warned that under a cuts-only budget, UC undergraduate fees could hit $20,000 to $25,000 a year. For weeks in the United States, there have been detectable levels of radiation from Japan in air and water, but not very much. Still, some public health officials have been critical of the EPA's monitoring system. They say it doesn't test things like milk frequently enough and that it often takes up to 3 weeks for results to be made public. But there is independent testing happening. Brian Edwards-Tiegert has the story.
It ships those samples. When the EPA collects samples for radiation testing, it ships those samples off to a lab in Alabama, then submits the data to heavy review before releasing it, which can delay the publication of results by 1 to 2 weeks. And for some things the EPA tests, it doesn't collect samples very often. Daniel Hirsch lectures in nuclear safety at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's also president of the nuclear policy organization, the Committee to Bridge the Gap.
EPA was saying that its normal process is to take water and milk samples every 3 months, and that obviously is ridiculous in the midst of this emergency. They now say they're speeding it up, but they don't say by how much.
Media staff at the EPA were unable to arrange an interview with a radiation expert in time for this story. The gaps in the EPA data have created unlikely internet rock stars out of the people doing independent testing.
Close to 120,000 hits now on our webpage.
That's Kai Vetter, a professor of nuclear engineering at UC Berkeley. After the accident in Japan, he and some grad students started their own testing regimen.
Originally, we started with air. So before it started to rain, it was just we had air. And we do that also with grass, local grass, and soil, and spinach, and even mushrooms.
They post their results online at nuc.berkeley.edu, and they post them a couple weeks faster than the EPA does. They also try to translate the numbers into what they call an effective dose.
So what we found is that you have to drink hundreds of liters of this rainwater to get the same exposure than a transcontinental round-trip flight.
Which, so over really long periods of time, people do drink hundreds of liters of water.
Yes, they do drink hundreds of liters, not of rainwater, though, enough of drinking water. And we have been able, indeed, to see iodine-131 in our tap water. But in our tap water, the concentration was 1,000 times smaller than what we observed in the rainwater.
Vetter's department is also running online forums where participants are parsing and critiquing their analysis. For instance, some posters say the cosmic radiation you get on an airplane can't be compared to the health effects of actually getting radioactive iodine in your body and having it concentrate in your thyroid gland. Vetter says that's a perfectly valid point, and his raw data is up online for anyone who would like to draw their own conclusions. Brian Edwards-Tiegert, Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Berkeley.
Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area today. Breezy with a chance of thunderstorms and possible hail. Highs in the 50s. Same in the North and East Bay Interior Valleys with highs in the 60s. And in the Central San Joaquin Valley today, 50% chance of rain with highs 56 to 61. I'll have more news at 10 a.m. on Letters and Politics. And please be sure to join us at 6 p.m. for the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Rose Katapchi.
Good morning. This is Peter Phillips from Project Censored on the Morning Mix Show. With me in studio today and part of our discussion is Cynthia Boaz, a professor of political science at Sonoma State University. Cynthia is also on the Media Freedom Foundation Board, which funds and participates in Project Censored. Our general topic is the tactics and strategies of nonviolent social movements. And our guest in studio this morning as a longtime social activist and a social movement person who's been arrested over 100 times, and that's Keith McHenry, one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome, Cynthia. Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Now, you're back in the Bay Area, Keith. You were out doing mountaintop removal work and feeding some of the activists there. Tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us why you're here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, well, Food Not Bombs has set up like kitchens for base camps at the mountaintop removal actions in Kentucky and West Virginia. And that same one of the same chapters in Knoxville, Food Not Bombs, I also worked with them to feed the action in down at the School of America's Watch, which is something that we do every year that's a real huge, like thousands of people that we feed at that protest. And we have chapters in 1,000 cities around the world, and so we're, like, active in all kinds of things. I was recently visiting Food Not Bombs in Reykjavik, Iceland, and it turned out the meal, which they had in downtown plaza around the corner from the Parliament building, evolved into a weekly Saturday protest to the Parliament building, which eventually turned into an uprising that overthrew the Icelandic government. And and that's an ongoing thing. There's a new wave of Food Not Bombs protesting in Iceland because of the new government that came in, didn't do any better than the old government. And we have chapters also providing food, like we did the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. We provide meals for that. We have we've been sharing food at strikes of auto workers in Seoul, South Korea. And we did a 600-day farm workers vigil in Bosnia-Herzegovina Park in Sarajevo. So we not only feed, like, hungry and homeless in all these cities, but we've done those things. We also are pretty well known for having provided the food relief for Katrina. And we also provided food to the rescue workers at 9/11 in Manhattan and over the Staten Island Ferry when they got off. Arby's roast beef followed our example. But it turned out because the roast beef sandwiches smelled a lot like the dead bodies in the in the Trade Center site, that they just left. None of the firefighters or cops would eat the roast beef. So our food's vegan and vegetarian, and it was really appreciated. It didn't smell like carcasses. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So the organization is a sort of a support system for other movements. And do you also consider it to be kind of a movement, a campaign itself? And if so, how would you describe the objectives and the strategy of...
Okay, well, yeah. So we're not only supporting, like, the food for the movement, but it's true, like, in both in the United States and now in Belarus, those are two countries that arrest us for feeding people. And Gene Sharp, who's a, you know, famous author of nonviolence, he has 198 methods of nonviolent direct action. So I met with him about 2 years ago to suggest he needed to add one more, which was sharing food in resistance to the state, because in the United States in particular, and San Francisco was the most famous, where there was nearly 1,000 arrests from 1988 to 97. You can just get arrested. The police held press conferences periodically to say they're arresting us because we're making a political statement, and that's not allowed. So just the mere act of handing out food has been criminalized, and particularly strong in California and Florida, but we've been arrested in Illinois, Massachusetts. We were arrested in Connecticut, and it resulted in a law that makes it so that everybody gets to share free food without needing to get a permit or anything like that. So it's right now we have two people in Belarus in prison because of the election. The dictator was trying to throw the election his way. He got like something like 90-some% of the vote. And one of the tricks was they had the secret police throw a Molotov cocktail at the Russian embassy, and then the secret police posted a thing on Indie Media, which is another project that Food Not Bombs started back in 95. And it's saying that anarchists have now attacked the Russian state, and this is beautiful. And it turned out that it was just a fabrication. So we have our chapters. We have three principles, which makes it possible for us to be fluid and organize protests in any kind of environment, whether it's Russia or Asia or the U.S. or Latin America. And the principles are that the food is always free and vegan or vegetarian to anybody without restriction, rich or poor, drunk or sober. That the each chapter is autonomous and makes decisions using a process called consensus. And that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action. And then you interpret it as to how you want to organize that in your community, and it makes it so that every chapter can be versatile and organize around the context of what social problems are happening in their society.
So is there one overall objective for the organization, or does each chapter kind of autonomously decide its own campaign and direction?
Well, there's basically two. Both things are true. So one of the main concepts is that we obviously have an abundance of food and resources, and that it's basically the way the society is organized that causes people to live in poverty. And then it can be a little bit more specific. So, for instance, in the United States, where it's over 50 cents of every federal tax dollar goes to the military, it's obvious. So, for instance, now where there's this huge austerity push, that we could redirect some of that defense spending or military spending towards things that would be actually make real security in the United States, mm-hmm. like food and housing and mm-hmm. and so on. So. So on the broadest sense, we're basically saying that food is a right, not a privilege, and that we could need to address the way that the society is organized in general.
Mm-hmm.
In some countries, you know, like where they don't really manufacture weapons, but maybe they buy them, like Nigeria has a huge military effort there, and they kill their own people, and the U.S. kills their people for them and stuff. You know, the idea is more against general militarism. They don't manufacture weapons in Nigeria, but they use their oil resources to buy weapons from the United States. So it might be slight shifts in that. Some chapters are more focused on animal rights because maybe that's what's happening more in their community. I know in Slovakia, when Czechoslovakia divided, the 20 chapters in the Slovakia side of the border, they decided an important thing was to make animal rescue shelters. So they set up the first animal rescue shelter system in Slovakia. So it all just depends. We also started this project called Anarchist Against the Wall in Palestine, and that was grew out of a peace camp that we were feeding on the West Bank, and then our friends that were farmers were locked out from their fields for their harvest. So the Funabans kids got some bolt cutters, and they got all their friends together. They went over to the Palestinian side from Tel Aviv. They marched to the wall, started cutting it down, and of course the Israeli Defense Forces shot at them for a while, and they keep doing periodically. The newest thing they're doing there is they use car jacks to lift your car up, to change a tire, to actually lift up segments of the concrete wall to dump it into the Israeli side. So, mm-hmm. you know, it all just depends on where you are and what
sure.
your food on bombs trip is. But it's broadly anti-militarism and the right for everybody to have what they need.
So you have activists worldwide in over 1,000 chapters, feeding people, engaging in nonviolent social action. You're here in the San Francisco Bay Area as part of the Anarchist Book Fair. I know you're going to be there out there in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Park this weekend, because we're going to be there with you.
Right.
But what's the overall goal here? What are you really trying to accomplish
in San Francisco specifically?
Well, let's talk about San Francisco and then the world.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm trying to do is to get more people to volunteer and start more chapters. Mm-hmm. So I'm at the Green Festival. I speak at a number of colleges in the area, and so the idea is to get people to join the Food Not Bombs movement, and either if they don't have a chapter in their local town. So like in the Anarchist Book Fair, we meet people from all over the Western United States. So a lot of them want to know how to do Food Not Bombs. So we have literature and information on how to start a chapter. And then the other thing that happens is a lot of the chapters come by and we like make suggestions on how they can improve their effectiveness. So we've had a big problem in the United States where we're heavily infiltrated by the FBI. We're considered one of the top terrorist groups. We were originally called America's Most Hardcore Terrorist Group in 1988, in November of 88. They did workshops for the National Guard all over the United States to discuss how to suppress Food Not Bombs at that time. And if you remember, the Soviet Union still existed. So what has happened is that we've had this problem where informants will join the chapter and suggest that we're a charity and that we shouldn't have literature and we shouldn't have a banner. So we've been trying to reinstitute this idea that we're really like about social change and that we're not not a charity, and it's really important to have the information and to organize for change and have a banner. And the San Francisco chapter was very heavily infiltrated, and they were to a point where all they were doing is handing out like a little bit of, they were doing a lot of food, but there was a church group that handed out Bible tracts at our meals, and everybody thought we were just a church and didn't realize we were actually a social change group. That's been a problem because people look at San Francisco Food Not Bombs as the famous chapter because we were arrested so many times. So when you volunteer for San Francisco Food Not Bombs and there's no literature and there's no banner, then you reproduce this like not very effective group. And so part of my reason of being here is to encourage chapters to realize that we're solidarity and we're not charity, and to try to emphasize amongst all the groups that pass through the Anarchist Book Fair that you can pick up literature from us, that you can print your own literature. We have it on the website that you can download PDFs, and that we have banners. We have information on how to make banners, and we should try to let. And that we're trying to be, particularly now with the budget cuts, where I just hear NPR the other day and stuff like that. They don't even talk about cutting defense spending, but they're going to cut every other aspect of society, right? And Food Not Bombs chapters all over the world are dealing with that. We've been feeding the protests in many parts of the world. We had our translator, Arabic translators from Libya, and I haven't heard from him in a long time since he started translating the seven steps to starting the Food Not Bombs chapter. He kind of just disappeared. Mm-hmm. That's when the uprising started. Mm-hmm. But we had groups in Cairo. We have groups in Amman, Jordan. So we're all dealing with this kind of basic idea that food prices are going way up. Monsanto Corporation is raising prices of seeds and their chemicals, and that's contributing. More food is going to fuel instead of food. Things, the whole way the economy is organized is really pressuring poor people, and it's essentially collapsing globally. So Food Not Bombs has that as a, we're feeding the people that are, failed by the system, but we're trying to bring the people together that we're feeding to organize resistance.
Well, I'm curious, building on a couple of the comments that you just made, whether you have any specific tactics for dealing with or preempting the potential for agent provocateurs, if you have a way of identifying folks in the organization who might be there for impure kinds of reasons, and how you deal with that. And I'm also curious about your larger recruitment strategy. I mean, I know that you're going to the book fair and you come on KPFA, and I'm sure that you have a lot of other events and other ways that you get the message out. But what is the big picture strategy for disseminating the message and recruiting? Because like many social justice movements within the U.S. and outside, there's some marginalization, right? And you want to be able to, sort of win over the larger population, right? And so how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, well, that's interesting because one of the things we saw when we started this in 1980 was that the activist groups were doing in those days, you didn't have email and web, so you were calling people up, and you were, if you were organized at all, you did some putting up posters to get people, but you were in an office somewhere, so people didn't know how to run into you, and you didn't have a storefront. So our strategy has always been to set up a literature table with our food in a high trafficked area, so that the random public walks by and they see the food, they see the literature, and they get engaged in the conversation. Though the food, at the beginning, Reagan had just got elected, so our concern was that he would create policies that would cause homelessness and hunger and an economic crisis in the United States. That wasn't totally existing at that time, and we were hoping people would join us to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Reaganomics has succeeded in undermining the entire society. So we're out on the streets still, trying to talk to regular people. So we're sort of taking over public space temporarily for two or three hours. We include things like cultural events, like music and puppet shows and films on the street, things like that to try to encourage, the public to stop and eat our food. Slow, you know, if you they eat some food, they have to hang. They kind of hang there for at least until they're done eating. That and they see the literature and they go, oh wow, yeah, yeah. You're like against this war somewhere, and then it evolves into a conversation. If you don't have that literature and banner and stuff, people don't know why you're even there. They just assume you're a church group feeding people, and then you lose that whole dynamic. So then once people find out what you're doing, I have had so many occasions where people come up to me and gone, wow, I thought I was the only one against the war in Iraq. I didn't, you know, no one at my work talks about being against the war in Iraq. I am like shocked that there's other people that know about the war in Iraq. And as a result, they are, you know, it changes their whole life. So we have grown from 8, you know, college students in 1980 to you know, probably tens of thousands of people all over the world, mainly by just standing out on a street corner with food, talking to people walking by who would otherwise never know that there was opposition to all these things. And I tell lots of young people that's really key. Now, for the infiltration issue, most of the problems that we have like a number of friends that are in prison right now. Eric McDavid helped me organize a Free Not Bombs gathering in Philadelphia, and then a few months later, he was framed on bombing a dam on the Sacramento River, which he'd never intended to do. And the woman was his so-called girlfriend, which turned out to be an FBI informant, paid $65,000 a year to work with Food Not Bombs, and she or $65,000, I'm not sure how, if it was by a year or like for the whole time of trying to get rid of us, but that's what she claimed she was paid. The issue was that she joked about or made comments that we should bomb this dam if we're serious about being really radical and so on. And even though Eric was just, he's a poet and he's really quiet and everything, so he just kind of like never said anything. So now what we're saying to people, like if in the RNC 8, which was the 8 Food Not Bombs activists and organizing the welcoming committee in Minneapolis, and the infiltrators, we had 3 people live with us in the 3 cookhouses, and then we had 2 other people that came to our meetings, and those informants would joke about how we should firebomb the Republicans and the police mm-hmm. when the convention. So, yeah, so we've made a real huge point that if people are joking about or even suggesting any kinds of violence, that we just make a point saying, look, other people have gone to prison because of people joking in our meetings. You can't joke in our meetings about bombing stuff and using violence. You have
like joking on an airplane or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's the same thing.
There's this principle of all successful nonviolent movements, which is nonviolent discipline. It has to be strictly maintained, and so it's something Gandhi and King and others, even in more contemporary movements, have been able to really effectively convey. You mentioned the Orange Revolution. Right. They did this in Egypt as well. If a movement is well organized and well strategized, then and you can be confident that those activists who are there for the right reasons are dedicated to this principle of nonviolent discipline, then this is a very telling sign that you've got someone who may be there for other reasons, right? Who's encouraging breaking with that. So that zero tolerance policy of even any suggestions
of
violence.
Yeah, that's really important.
Yeah, it's critical.
Yeah. In the Food Not Bombs movement, it's obvious that we're food not bombs, and you know, I've been pulled off of planes and questioned and had all my information taken off of me at like Chicago Airport and other places like that. I was just actually pulled out of my van at gunpoint crossing into the U.S. in Vermont, and they do treat us like terrorists. But yeah, it's really important. And one of the things we've in the area of nonviolence is super important that we're reinstituting is nonviolence training. So for instance, we used to do that a lot in the anti-nuclear movement back in the 70s the war in El Salvador, the movement there. So that before actions, and I'm just finished a new book where I have a whole segment on why we're doing nonviolence trainings and how and to plan that into your actions. And I think a lot of people just don't realize how empowering nonviolence really can be, and we lost that. There was a for a while there was this this idea that it was either racist, that if you were nonviolent, you were racist. You know, so I was getting a lot of emails and talk of that because people of color have to be violent. So, you know, we're just, that's white privilege. And then, you know, and then I point out, well, Gandhi wasn't exactly all that white, nor was Martin Luther King, and they advocated nonviolent direct action. And we need to rebuild that heritage that, we did a tent city action in San Francisco for 27 days where we just camped in front of City Hall. About 500 people, mostly homeless, lived with us. It was so empowering. And we've been promoting this idea of these tent city protests. That's what the Orange Revolution was a tent city protest. That was what was in Cairo. That's what's in Oman and Yemen and all these countries. And that, I think, is something Food Not Bombs can really do. If you want to find out more, we have a website, foodnotbombs.net. And you can check out what we're doing on there. And it has information on how to start a group, how to join your local chapter. And then also we have a toll-free number, a hunger hotline that we put out for homeless people. You can walk up to any payphone and call us at 1-800-884-1136. And that's ways people can get involved. And I hope to see – I'll be both at the Green Festival. We'll have a table at the Green Festival and at the Anarchist Book Fair. And we have tons of information on how to get involved in Food Not Bombs.
Keith, thanks so much. It sounds like as a nonviolent social movement, what you're doing, feeding people worldwide, is a very important thing to do. You're supporting social movements, and we really encourage and support you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much. And if you have any organizations out there that needs food brought to your nonviolent direct action, we can feed you up to, the longest we've done is 2 years. So if you have an occupation that you need to have for 2 years, or you're striking labor union, we really encourage you to work with us because we'd love to provide food for all your actions.
Okay.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Well, we're going to take a short music break right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Cynthia Boaz, you're here in studio with me. You're an expert, and you study nonviolent tactics and strategies. And we just heard from Keith McHenry from Food Not Bombs, which is clearly a nonviolent group, and they're feeding poor people worldwide. And he mentioned Gene Sharp.
Yeah.
And you've read Gene Sharp. I have, too.
I've read Gene Sharp quite a bit. Yeah.
And
it's encouraging, actually, to hear him
mention, because he has 200 different tactics of nonviolent social action and strategy.
It was officially the 198, although my understanding is that has been expanded significantly, especially over the last decade in the series of colored revolutions and even in the more recent wave of uprisings going on in North Africa and the Middle East. We keep adding new tactics. There's always room for something else.
It seems that core to this and core to social movements is nonviolence is a democratic process. I mean, we're seeing democratic movements worldwide challenging dictatorships, challenging American imperialism in the world, the global empire process, war, and civilians. So, can we change the world in this capacity?
I think it's the only way we can change the world.
I think so, too.
One of the core principles of nonviolent action, both from the perspective of principled nonviolence and also from the perspective of strategic nonviolent action, is the idea that means and ends are inseparable. And so the way through which you achieve change then determines the culture or the setting in which whatever comes next emerges. So anything that's won through violence has to be sustained through violence. And so, like you said, when you're talking about creating democracy or expanding rights, or overcoming oppression in some way, opening up political space, it makes sense. It makes the most sense, and is the most the lowest legitimate means of doing that is through democratic, grassroots, organic nonviolent action, because people are actually learning democracy by engaging in that process. And then it also creates more potential for a legitimate system over the long term.
There's some strategists that will say, though, that's nonviolent action, that the elites just don't pay attention to us. And it's that threat of violence. Like Ted Rall will say,
right,
there needs to be this sort of possible violence, or maybe some, you know, firebombed military headquarters or something to get their attention.
Yeah, I think that that's a mythology. And I think that that's intentionally perpetuated by those who are the targets of massive nonviolent action, because they understand that they can delegitimize either the movement or the tactics if they can make that message resonate. But in fact, historically, in most movements that have had a radical flank, you know, a group behind them, kind of in the shadows, with the potential for violent action, those are the places where movements have actually taken longer to succeed. I know a couple of folks working on this question in a very empirically rigorous way, Kurt Schock at Rutgers and Erica Chenoweth at Wesleyan are studying this question. And what they've discovered so far is that when there is a presence of a violent or potentially violent insurrectionary group alongside a nonviolent movement, it actually hinders the ability of that nonviolent movement to do their work.
I think that's so important to understand that and bring that forward. In studio with me this morning, I'm Peter Phillips from Project Censored. It's Cynthia Boaz, professor of political science at Sonoma State University, and studies nonviolent social movements and tactics. Now, joining us online right now is Jeff Mackler. He's a longtime Bay Area anti-war organizer, party secretary of the Socialist Faction, and organizer of the mobilization of Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. But also, he's engaging and organizing in the anti-war, anti-nuke march that's happening this Sunday. So, Jeff, are you there?
I am, and glad to be with you, Peter.
Thank you very much. Tell us what's happening on Sunday.
Well, we're hoping to have a breakthrough demonstration in San Francisco Sunday. We assemble at Dolores Park at 11 o'clock for a 12 noon rally and a 1:30 march through the Mission District, and then a closing rally at about 3 o'clock. And we think that we have perhaps the broadest national anti-war coalition. We're doing the same thing on Saturday in New York City, and this is our San Francisco bi-coastal end of it. What's amazing about this march is the breadth of support. We have some 800 national and regional organizations supporting it, ranging from the largest unions in New York City to Palestinian organizations, Egyptian organizations, civil liberties groups, the National Lawyers Guild, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And they are coming together not just on one issue, but in a whole series of issues which sort of indicate the collective irrationality that permeates government policy today. Of course, the main demand in San Francisco is rally against the wars at home and abroad. And of course, at home, we're talking about attacks in Wisconsin and Ohio and 17 other states. We're talking about the 17 states that want to criminalize Muslim practices and defense of civil liberties. And we're talking about racism, the criminal justice system, including the persecution of people who challenge the status quo, like Mumia Abu-Jamal and Lynn Stewart. We're demanding the immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from virtually everywhere in the world, everywhere there are U.S. troops, and U.S. aid to dictators in North America and the Middle East, hands off Iran, bring the troops home from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So it's the first time that we've combined all these issues, and now, of course, no nukes, no war. The incredible situation that threatens the future of the Japanese, if not the people of the world, with nuclear power plants. And, of course, we have 100 of those deadly nukes, or more than 100 in the United States, that at any moment could sink into the kind of catastrophic disaster that spews deadly radiation around the globe and makes life impossible for a millennium for the people in the immediate region, if not the longer term. So we have a broad coalition mobilizing. I think what we're doing was captured by one of the Wisconsin workers who carried a sign after three demonstrations and a couple of weeks of 100,000 each, which said, "Fight like an Egyptian. Bring out the masses into the street. Bring out the millions of people that are the only ones that have the capacity to change this irrational society we live in." So we're looking forward to a major turnout this Sunday in San Francisco at Dolores Park between 18th and 19th in Dolores. We have some 60 speakers and entertainers, and those are the broadest range of speakers you can ever imagine.
Hi, Jeff. I wanted to ask you a question about, you mentioned the breadth of this this series of protests, and you know, one of the concerns that I have about massive social justice protests and even movements within the U.S. Particularly, but around the world, is that oftentimes the message is diluted because there's so many different organizations and different causes kind of simultaneously pressing multiple demands, each of which is critical. But, you know, from the perspective of strategy, it makes it much more difficult for those activists who are showing up and being asked to press these grievances to know, you know, in a coherent way what it is they're being asked to push for. So I'm just curious, you sort of touched on it, but could you talk a little bit more about whether or not there's really a focused objective here, and if so, what that is?
Okay, that's a wonderful question, and we're all discussing and debating it. This action is supported by the United National Anti-War Committee that came out of a conference in Albany in July of 800 people. And we discussed and debated for 3 days how many and which issues we should raise. You know, I'm sort of the generation that came out of the Vietnam era, where we only had supposedly one major national issue: bring the troops home now. We killed 4 million people in Vietnam, and that was the central focus. But those were the times when the United States was still emerging from World War II as the preeminent imperial power, and we had, quote, guns and butter. That is, we could kill millions in Vietnam and Southeast Asia and have social programs in the United States that tripled the money that went into public education, improved the quality of medical care, and even closed the racial gap between black and whites, black and white in this country. Today we have an irrational world. We have a world economic crisis of the world capitalist system, and it has spread its tentacles to every nation on earth. And the world is in revolt, as we saw in North Africa and in Latin America. And the United States has literally over 2,000 military bases everywhere. And we've seen the most unprecedented cuts in social services in our lifetimes in every sphere. Tuition at UC Berkeley goes up 32% in all state colleges last year, on another 8% firing of thousands of teachers. These issues didn't exist back then. So our central demand on Sunday is rally against the wars at home and the wars abroad. We would feel quite unusual if we didn't take a position on the deadly issue of nuclear power that is facing the Japanese people. And the same thing with U.S. troops constantly organized to intervene everywhere in the world where people struggle against the economic conditions that are created by a society that preferences the rich, the banks, bailing out banks to the tune of $17 billion, spending a trillion dollars, and spending a trillion a year on war. So it's not it's not that we made a conscious decision to focus on many issues and dilute our message. It's that life itself has attacked working people all over the world on a multitude of issues that have brought them into the streets, and they themselves are beginning to see kinds of connections.
We're going to have to move on here, but we're really looking forward to being there. The Morning Mix crew and many people from KPFA are going to assemble with you this Sunday at 11 in Dolores Park. We hope the park is big enough to hold the numbers of people in the Bay Area that feel strongly about these issues, and we're really glad to have you. I was in Albany with you last fall, and the Project Censored was there, and we think that full transparency of what government is doing and no censorship is a big part of these issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much for being on with us.
Peter, I'm honored to do so, and see you on Sunday at Dolores Park.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Take care.
Well, Cynthia, we're hearing about marches. We're hearing about feeding people. Another nonviolent social action tactic, of course, is hunger strikes.
Mm-hmm.
This is certainly Gandhi did that, and a number of people has, Cesar Chavez.
Yes.
And we have online with us right now Richard Koshner, who is an immigration attorney and a member of the Committee for Immigrant Rights in Sonoma County. He was on a couple days ago, but Richard, are you with us?
I am. Good morning, Peter.
Thank you. You're on a hunger strike, so tell us why and what's happening up there in Sonoma County.
Well, the reason, there are several reasons. I think probably everybody who goes on fast or hunger strike goes on for personal reasons as well as political. Before I went on, I looked at Cesar Chavez's reasons and the Quakers' reasons. I attend the Quaker meeting up here, and they're always kind of dual, personal and political. For me, I feel an enormous amount of frustration here in Sonoma County after 4 years of trying to get the sheriff and the Board of Supervisors to look hard at this business of how we are assisting the Federal Immigration Agency, ICE, in deporting large numbers of immigrants through arrests over minor traffic and other misdemeanors, and putting them in the jail and then funneling them on to ICE through our jail, not only through the Secure Communities Program, but also through the Criminal Alien Program. And after 4 years of all kinds of different nonviolent tactics, we're still sending 70 people a month out of this, you know, relatively small county in California. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of families that get broken up every month. We have statistics dating from the start of Secure Communities that show that 921 people have been turned over to ICE just from our county, you know, in about a year since March. So that's the political side. The personal side is the enormous frustration that has sometimes turned to resentment for me. And I do believe in the adage that you can really only do this work out of love. And if you're doing it with resentment, then you need to make a change. And the FAST has helped me get back to where I need to be in that.
Richard, can I ask you, do you have, is this part of a larger strategy, you know, to press this issue? And how are you getting promoted? I mean, how are you getting your message out that, and getting, you know, sympathy of the larger population within Sonoma County or even
right.
California or more broadly?
Good questions. It's part of a larger movement in the sense that we have been at this for 4 years. We've tried petitioning. We took 4,500 signatures to the sheriff, and then when he didn't accept them, we took copies to the Board of Supervisors and got no response from them. We had meetings with supervisors. We got involved in the 2008 election process, won a little and lost a little there. Started a lawsuit in 2008 against the sheriff and ICE. We're still in federal court on that and trying to settle out with some some victories there. But we also worked through the Commission on Human Rights here, and they came up with a resolution that tells the Board of Supervisors that they ought to change their practice with respect to immigrants. But the supervisors have found a way to delay and delay and ignore what the Commission on Human Rights has said, and it's just been enormously frustrating. So this step was taken after many other tactics were tried, and so it's part of a larger movement, and it's not just an act of desperation, it's an act of attempting inspiration. Mm-hmm. What I'm finding is that, getting to the second part of your question, how is this being promoted, how are we getting the word around, it's mainly in the immigrant community and amongst the activists of the Committee for Immigrant Rights that I'm concerned about getting the word around. I hope that what I'm doing will add a little spark of inspiration to get people to tell their supervisors they won't tolerate any more delay. Mm-hmm. And make the supervisors begin to feel that this issue is not just going away because they delay with dealing with it. There will be, I believe, an article in our local paper, the Santa Rosa paper, this weekend, focusing on the 70 families or the 70 persons turned over to ICE every month from our jail, with a sidebar about my fast and my efforts.
I'm glad to hear that. My next question, Richard, was going to be why the New York Times Press Democrat hadn't covered this so far. You've been fasting for close to a week now, I understand.
Today is the eighth day, and, I did not actually reach out to the media. As I mentioned, my main concern was to offer some level of inspiration, kind of wake-up call to my fellow activists, and get them to put some heat on the supervisors. But and I really don't know what the effect of going to the Press Democrat will be. They'll publish their piece, but will it wake up the crazy people more than it, actually inspire sympathetic people? I really don't know how that will come out, but we'll see.
Well, if they write more than a news article and maybe have an op-ed, that will help. And certainly the supervisors read the paper.
That's true.
And I sent an email to my supervisor yesterday, and I think as many people that do that, and we build this up, it seems like a simple thing to say that undocumented people who are put in jail just because they can't be identified, have not committed any crime, should be held for ICE. That doesn't make sense to me.
No, we find that some 42% of those 70 people turned over to ICE every month are identified by ICE in their secure community statistics as non-criminals. They have no conviction at all. Another 30% have only what are called level 3 convictions. That's two or fewer misdemeanors. If you have three misdemeanors, you go into level 2. And you have to remember that driving without a license is a misdemeanor. So if you've been caught doing that three times in your 15 years here in California, then you would fall into level 2. 72.5% of all of the people being turned over are either level 3 or non-criminal. So you're right, Peter, and thank you for communicating with your supervisor, and I hope hundreds of people will.
Richard, I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
Questions and suggestions. I think it's very it's noble at a really personal, spiritual level that what you're doing to make this very strong statement.
Thanks.
I also think that you have the potential to even have a much broader and more profound effect. And if you're not getting, if the message isn't getting out through the mainstream media venues, you do have the option of owning the narrative and creating the story yourself or others that are in solidarity with you.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all kinds of tools, including social media, which we've seen being used in these really creative and effective ways in various campaigns for rights and justice and against oppression around the world, over the last couple of months. So I would suggest investing a little bit of time in looking into how you can get this message disseminated through these various venues. And I'm thinking that this is going to resonate pretty broadly, and it may be much more powerful than you're even anticipating. So you can really magnify the effect of what you're doing. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, on a personal level, is this working so far? Are you feeling more or less empowered over the last 8 days? Like, what's happening for you at that level of spiritual resilience and commitment to this?
Thanks for asking. First of all, on the social media, I'm not very good at it. 53 years old, not of the generation. I know some 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds are quite good at it, but not me. Anyway, colleagues, friends, fellow activists have started, and there's some good stuff up on Facebook already about the fast. Evelina Molina, one of the commissioners for human rights here in Sonoma County, has put up some very good stuff on Facebook, and I'm very grateful. In terms of, am I feeling more empowered? Physically, you know, in the first day or two or three, you actually experience more energy. But in the last 4 or 5 days, I've definitely been feeling tired, and today is a pretty tired day. That's physically. Spiritually, it has helped. I really do feel less resentment. I have to admit, I told the morning program on Monday, some of my resentment was misdirected at the victims themselves, and I find that I don't have the temptation to do that much anymore. I'm not blaming the victims in my own mind nearly as much, and so that's been very helpful in terms of more interpersonal empowerment. I am seeing response from the activist community. It's been very heartening. I think that the sacrifice, which admittedly is really pretty small. I'm drinking juices. I'm not experiencing the hunger of the people of Oaxaca or Chiapas or Guatemala or, you know, I'm just experiencing more hunger than most Americans feel, I think. And that bit of sacrifice has worked some level of inspiration, and it's been very encouraging.
Richard, it's good to hear from you. You're on a hunger strike. You're part of the immigrant rights community in Sonoma County. You're asking the Board of Supervisors to instruct the sheriff to stop deporting, cooperating with ICE and deporting people who haven't done anything criminal.
Exactly.
And that seems like a very important human rights issue. We're so much in solidarity with you on that. And we will keep up with how you're doing. I hope that you have a doctor who helps monitor your health in regards to this.
Better than that, I have a wife who's a physician assistant.
Oh, well, that's well too.
Yeah.
Cynthia Boaz is in studio with me. She's a professor at Sonoma State, has been helping out. We've been discussing how different tactics of social movements and nonviolent action are effective. We've covered the Food Not Bombs people, which feed people, and then we're talking to you who are not feeding yourself. And it sounds like whatever we do, and we work it collectively, that the can have impacts and that we can engage in these kinds of activities. So thank you so much for being on.
And Richard,
us.
I live in Sonoma County, and I would be happy to talk with you further about this.
Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciate that. Yeah. Wonderful questions and great ideas.
This is KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno and KPFA online. This has been the Morning Mix Show. I'm Peter Phillips from Project Censored, your host. Thank you very much. Up next, our community announcements and then Democracy Now!
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending April 17th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. On Monday, April 11th at 8 p.m., the Praxis Peace Institute will host John Perkins, author of the bestseller Confessions of an Economic Hitman, at the Sonoma Community Center, Andrews Hall, 276 East Napa Street, Sonoma. Tickets are $15. For details, call 707-939-2973. On Saturday, April 16th at 7 p.m., the Brava Theater will screen the new documentary, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up?, a film by Saul Landau with a live performance by the Cuban Cowboys. This benefit for the Cuban Five will take place at 2781 24th Street, San Francisco. Doors open at 6 p.m. Reception will follow the film. Tickets are $15. For details, call 510-219-0092. On Sunday, April 17th, the public can celebrate International Day of Peasant Struggles with the San Francisco Art Institute. This free event will take place at 800 Chestnut Street, San Francisco, from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. Through speakers, films, and food, this event will highlight Brazil's landless workers movement. For details, call 510-673-9666. The community calendar is produced by members of the KPFA Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929, Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Fax them to 510-848-3812. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.